Hello, this is Dr. Laura Hannes-Webb of VisionarySoul.com, author of The Gift of ADHD and Listening to Depression for my program, The Sweet Spot, which is sponsored by PsychJourneyPodcast.com and can be found at SweetSpotPodcast.com. Tune in weekly to find where your passion meets your purpose. This show is committed to helping you find, embrace, and live in your sweet spot. And today, I'll be interviewing Paul Johannides about his book, The Guide to Getting It On. Paul is a research psychoanalyst on the editorial board of the American Journal of Sex Education. He lives in the Northwest with his wife, daughter, dogs, and livestock. And his book, The Guide to Getting It On, was just featured in Oprah Magazine, and Rolling Stone called it the only sex manual you will ever need. Welcome, Paul.
Good morning.
Good. Well, it's wonderful to have you here.
Well, thanks for joining us here in the Northwest.
Yeah. Well, part of finding your sweet spot, what I call the place where your passion meets your purpose, is a transformation from living your life guided by performance demands to living your life guided by pleasure. And I thought your book was such an important part of that, at least in the area of sexuality. And even in the Oprah magazine, they commented that this is a potentially sex life-changing guide. Can you tell us how this could change our sex lives?
Boy, I don't trust any book that says it's going to change your life, unless you've got a pretty flimsy life.
Great point.
Let's hope there's more substance there than something a book can come in and change. One of the things that maybe the book does, maybe one of its, if it's got a strength, maybe it's its strength, is that it for some reason or another helps people open up and talk to each other more about sex. In fact, in the college courses they use it in, that's one of the big things they say, is that, gosh, it gets students talking about things in the first week that they wouldn't ordinarily talk about till the 10th week. And so maybe there's something about it that helps relieve anxiety or shame, or I don't know what it is, the things that kind of get in the way from us from being able to talk to a partner about sex.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's also very comprehensive. I was thinking, you know, it's 854 pages. It's one of those big books that kind of looks like a coffee table book.
Well, dimensionally, it's the size of a porn star penis. about 9 inches long by 2 inches thick. So.
Oh, great planning. I didn't catch on to that.
I hadn't either until recently.
Yeah, and like any good coffee table book, it also has lots of pictures, which is another part of it. So you're thinking that it opens up conversations, it makes people feel comfortable. And I was also intrigued by your background as a psychoanalyst. How do you think that influences either its accessibility or the insights it has to offer? Do you see any connection there?
You know, it does in a powerful way on one level, and it doesn't on another level. And here's how I'll try to explain that. In my psychoanalytic training, I can't ever remember sex mentioned in a healthy way. It's usually some sort of pathology, or it's a manifestation of some sort of something weirdness that's going on. That's unfortunate. That's I think part of any kind of rigorous psychological training or depth therapy training. You look at everything in kind of with a jaundiced eye.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, as I look back over it and I look through the book, there's a lot of psychoanalytic concepts that aren't burdened by the psychoanalytic terminology. You know, just in terms of intimacy and in some ways, that's when I was writing the book, I was always alerted to anxiety and people's anxiety and how we deal with that. So I guess it was, you know, looking at the subject with a psychoanalytic eye, but not burdening people with psychoanalytic theory, if that's of any help.
Yeah, well, I think the thing that's striking about it as a book is that it's actually, it's not just a how-to manual. It's entertaining, it's funny, it's fun, and it's kind of an interesting mix. And so it's interesting what you're saying about the anxiety, because I think it hits perfectly at that level, in the sense that you're like, oh yeah, this is entertaining, you know, I'm not reading this because I'm a perv, or, you know, it kind of gets, the humor gets around some of that and makes it very accessible, I think.
Well, thank you, because that took a lot of tequila to be able to reach that level of, of balance.
So is that a writing tip too? That's how you...
Well, I try not to, but every once in a while, if I'm really, really, really stuck on something and I'm going at it for weeks and my wife's about ready to strangle me because I've shown her, you know, the same passage the 300th time, she'll say, time to get the bottle. Because for some reason, it usually helps lift the block and allows me to just step back and laugh. But, you know, that doesn't happen more than once every month or two.
Well, that's a great writing tip out there for all those aspiring writers, too.
Well, I suppose it depends. If you turn into a mean drunk, it's not such a good thing. I tend to get deliriously happy. In fact, my wife is always kind of saying, well, have something to drink. She wishes I would do it more often. But for a lot of people, that's not such a good thing.
Yeah, so have a little bit of caution, knowing how that it will interact with your either mean-spiritedness or happiness.
Why is it that mean drunks are never aware that they're mean when they're drunk? I guess that's a different subject for a different time.
Yeah, well, so kind of getting to the heart of the book, do you have any, what would you say is the most interesting sex tip that you would have for people who wanted to increase their pleasure?
You know, that's a difficult one, and that's one when the women's magazines call you up, the Cosmo or Glamour or Marie Claire or whatever, and they want to know what are the three most important sexual fantasies that women have, or that men have, or what's the most important sex tip, and I always say, gosh, I said, you know, I'll tell them, are you wearing the same thing as your sister or your best friend today? Say, well, no. And I say, you mean you didn't come to work wearing the exact same thing as the person who shares the cubicle next to you? No. Same underwear? No. Same hairdo? No. Well, why in the blazes do you think you'd have the same sex fantasies, and why do you think that what works for her sexually is going to work for you sexually?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, that's what my editor told me. We need to sell magazines, and people seem to buy them when we've got those headlines. Yeah, but that doesn't work in reality. So I really try to help. If there's one thing I could help listeners about, it's really be cautious when you see something that says, here's the best sex tip of all time. To me, the best sex tip of all time is to try to listen to each other. But that won't sell magazines because that requires too much work.
Yeah. Well, how do you think then about this whole thing is about technique versus what you're saying when you say listening, is, you know, is there a problem with an over-focus on technique or performance demands? And so what role would your book play in guidance in that way?
You know, I think a balance is maybe helpful between the two. I think maybe if you understand some things about technique and things that will help you and your partner. One of the things like people sometimes say, what couples will say, is they'll read a book together, or a book like mine together, and they'll kind of highlight which parts are meaningful for them that they wish their partner would know more about. Mm-hmm. And those can be technique things, certainly. You know, that's a way of going about it that's safe. It's not saying to your partner, look, you dork, I've told you 500 times that you can't get it. It's maybe saying, oh, well, look at this. Let's talk about this way of touching me in here. And gosh, it's, you know, the book says a lot of guys have a kind of a struggle to know how I touch myself there. Look, here's some ways we might approach it. You might put your finger over mine and feel what I'm doing. What if we tried that, or something of that nature?
So it may be a good strategy for couples to, you know, actually use the book, maybe drink a bottle of tequila using your strategy. It's how you wrote it. Maybe it's a good way to read it.
Maybe. That's a fine thing. I also didn't mention that a lot of it was written while I was sitting with my dog under the big date tree at the east end of Topanga Beach, which is near Malibu in Los Angeles. So maybe you should start with a vacation to the beach.
Yeah. All good advice for a romance. And speaking of which, what is the difference between romance and sex, and how are they connected?
Well, if you can have a one-night stand, why waste time on romance? But if you're going to have a long-term relationship, then I think romance is pretty essential, because mm-hmm. You're going to get tired of each other really quick. You know that hot flash that's there the first year, that kind of goes away after the first year. And then you've really got to have a reason for making love to someone. As opposed to the fantasy of it being good enough to make you want to be with them.
Right.
You start to notice their faults. You start to notice a lot of things that you didn't notice at the start when you were just so hot to crawl into bed with them. And so if you get romance going from the get-go, that kind of helps, I think. It's when the romance stops that there's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I was also wondering, your book is so open-minded, as you were saying. It's like you kind of rebelled against, whether it be your psychoanalytic training or your Catholic school days or whatever it was. Have you, and I know you also, through your website, you take in lots of feedback from and do research there. How often or ever have things come through where you're just like, wow, that's even over the top for me, or that's really freaky? I mean, is there that difference that you make?
Oh, you mean that stuff with the family dog?
No, I didn't know about that.
poor Rover. it's not that often mm-hmm. that something blows me away in that sense. Every once in a while it does, and I kind of go, yuck. But I guess I don't get that much weirdness. Mm-hmm. And if I start, we're gonna have you to blame.
Okay. You mean if we start what?
If I start hearing weird things on the website, we'll know whose fault it is.
It'll be all my fault.
It's your listeners.
Yeah, that's right. It's an interesting demographic here. Yeah. So I know from a little bit in our, we've talked before, you don't buy too much into this idea of, you know, what a woman wants versus what a man wants. What are your thoughts on that? Is it that, you know, over time, you know, our culture is just so liberated now, there's not much of a big difference? Or has it always been that way and there's just been all this repression? I mean, what are your thoughts about men versus women and what they want or need?
Well, it depends whose studies you've read. Over the years, a long time ago, the first studies I started reading were by some top-rate psychologists who basically said, look, when we have men and women in groups of men and groups of women, they behave like the stereotype. But when we look at them as individuals, when we take them out of their groups of women and they don't think anyone's watching, the differences seriously break down. Even on what are they finding now in terms of aggression, right? If women think that they're being observed, they're not nearly as aggressive as if they don't think they're being watched.
Oh, interesting.
In fact, they can show up on certain tests being more aggressive than men if they think they're not being watched. And what was the one recently that
women
the idea that
talk
what?
As much?
Yeah, the idea that men are quiet and women are always talking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's crazy. What I do see, interestingly, is it seems that when it comes to sex on our surveys consistently over the years, women write a great deal more than men.
Oh.
Men seem to answer in kind of monosyllabic grunts, where women are very verbal. And I don't know if that's just writing. I don't know if it would be different if they were here and talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
It could change. But overall, in terms of desire and everything else, I mean, I hear a lot more from women who say my sex drive is higher than my partner's, but that's not the stereotype.
No, it's not, and that's definitely breaking down some of those stereotypes. And I remember when I was in college and taking a course that at least covered sex education, and someone said it's kind of like the definitive statement to, you know, sum up the difference between sexes is men play at love to get sex and women play at sex to get love. And I just wonder, I mean, do you have any thoughts on that? Is that true maybe developmentally at different points across the lifespan, or is it just a bunch of BS?
You know, I wonder if that isn't better to sell books than anything else, you know, back to the old men are from one planet and women are from the other.
Right.
I'm not so sure. Could be, and maybe not. I think it depends in part by the individual. And again, the phase of life you're in. I think what we want from sex tends to change over time for different people in different ways. I the idea that you are who you are at age, you know, sexually at age 18 is the same person you're going to be sexually at age 48, I don't think is true.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you've got a really good way of blocking out everything and not letting anything in.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we grow. I'll tell you what's interesting on our surveys on our website. I almost always can tell without even looking at the woman's age or the man's age when they're older, if they're in their late 30s or 40s. And I almost much prefer reading the surveys from people who are in their 30s or 40s because they just have so much more of a depth of life experience.
Yeah.
The people who are in their early 20s, they may be extremely sexual, incredibly sexual, but the depth of life experience isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect that changes one, that depth of life experience, and it probably changes what you want from sex. And it could be that also as you get older, your hormones and what surges through your body changes what you want.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything more you can say about that? That's really intriguing, this idea that, there's this quality that makes the older people's information somehow, I don't know, more engaging or interesting or revealing. I'm not sure what the quality is.
I don't know what that quality is, but I was discussing it with a researcher from Canada, and she had one of the few really interesting research papers I've seen in the last couple of years. And it's she interviewed people who are older, people who are in their 60s and 70s about great sex, and the things that she found are pretty fascinating. You know, the idea that great sex just occurs in committed long-term relationships, these people kind of blew that one out of the water. But, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But it also comes with a letting go of your expectations, a letting go of worrying what your butt looks like, a letting go of so many things, of how I'm going to perform, and an ability to just really get into the moment. And I was telling her about this situation. I said, you know, it's interesting. Your people are in their 60s, and they have such wonderful things to say about sexuality. I said, I found that in the surveys. I told her what I discovered, that I find people who are older have more to say that I find fascinating. And she says, that's been our case. We've tried interviewing people of all ages, and we find that as they get older, they have things that are more interesting.
Wow.
About sexuality. Now, maybe that's in inverse to how our society values sex and the body. You know, the body has to be perfect, right? You look and you see this 24 or 23 year old model who's been barfing her brains out to make sure she has no bulges anywhere. But her depth of awareness isn't probably as great as it's going to be when she's 40 or 50 and doesn't have what we consider to be that perfect sexual body anymore.
Yeah, so it's definitely what you're reflecting on is exactly this move away from performance demands to intrinsic personal pleasure and being guided by pleasure and intimacy rather than what you're saying, the perfection. And it almost sounds like you're saying that there's, I think you keep coming back to what the media says and what sells magazines, that, and also what sells, you know, the diet industry and the cosmetic surgery industry, is this idea that sexuality and attractiveness is directly correlated to looking like those people in the magazines. And it sounds like what you're saying is, well, no, I mean, even when you're looking at really older people, 60 years old and on, that they have, it sounds like what you're saying, they're having great sex lives, and it doesn't have to do with all of that.
Right, right. And something else that was interesting in her study, again, is that they felt that intimacy, again, didn't have to be in long-term relationships, that sometimes people felt they achieved incredible intimacy in brief encounters. Now, what's the perception of intimacy and reality of intimacy? I don't know. But I thought that was kind of fascinating.
Yeah, that's intriguing. And some of what you're saying reminds me of, I think, a really compelling case study that you had in the book, in your chapter called Intercourse, Horizontal Jogging. You talked about Dick, Craig, and Laura. Do you remember that case study?
Right.
Yeah, can you talk about that? Because it just, again, it's one of those things that it just blows apart stereotypes and our ideas of what people would find enjoyable.
Right. Well, you know, you've got this woman who's talking about two lovers. She's had one she was with before and one now. And the one before was, you know, the perfect frat man, the perfect body, the perfect biceps, the perfect penis, the perfect everything. And then that was her former boyfriend. And the current boyfriend is the guy who is a paraplegic. He used to be a football player, had an injury on the field, and he doesn't work so well from the waist down now. And she has a lot more fun with her current boyfriend than she did with Mr. Perfect. And, you know, her current boyfriend makes her feel good, where I think maybe with Mr. Perfect, if she had orgasms, it was probably to make him feel like he was the perfect lover.
Mm-hmm.
And there are vast differences. So I think a question is how does your lover make you feel, as opposed to how perfect are they?
Right. And so, again, it's kind of breaking down this idea of one was by any, you know, cultural definition, the perfect lover. And maybe part of the problem was he certainly thought he was.
Yeah.
And that maybe was part of the problem. And the other one, you know, as you said, was in a wheelchair and not even fully functioning, and yet she very much preferred that experience.
Yeah. He made her feel attractive, and he made her feel feminine. And, again, she's a woman who has to compete in a man's world business-wise. And she said, you know, I'm dealing with men, and I'm masculine all day long. I want to feel like a woman at night. So I think that's kind of that's one of those things that are hard to measure. But I think they're very important.
Well, it seems like, again, such a powerful message about our confusion about what we want and what we need, and it's not a message you're going to get in a magazine.
So. No, because they really, the magazines by and large want you to feel like if you go through the checkout stand and you don't buy this month's whatever magazine, that woman ahead of you who did buy it is going to steal your man from you because she's going to know the latest sex position. Trouble being, would you really want the guy who was that easy to steal? But I think in large part, they really want you to feel very paranoid that there's some sort of magical tip out there that if you don't have it, good luck.
Wow. Yeah. And I think that's what's so refreshing about your book, is it really breaks through all of those myths, and it's not based on insecurity or, you know, this competition. You've got something to lose. It's based on, you know, a much more warm and friendly and liberating, if anything. So.
Well, it tries.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think it succeeds. So, Paul, can you tell our listeners where they can get your book or where they can find you or about your website?
The book is available at anywhere, Barnes & Noble, Urban Outfitters, any kind of bookstores, and it's called Guide to Getting It On. We always call it The Guide to Getting It On, but actually title-wise, it's Guide to Getting It On. The only reason that's important is because if you're doing a search, that's the way it'll come up. On Amazon, what's really strange about it is the third edition keeps coming up when you put the title in. But you really want to try to find the fifth edition. That's the current edition.
Oh, okay. Huh.
Yeah, don't let anyone sell you the fourth or the third edition.
Okay, that's a good...
Trust me, as the author, I can tell you. The book wasn't... I haven't been satisfied with it until the current edition.
Good, good. Well, that's good to know. Well, thank you so much, Paul. It's been great talking with you. And this is Dr. Laura Hannes-Webb of VisionarySoul.com.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.